You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a recent state Supreme Court ruling affirmed what's known as the once an adult, always an adult rule. We break down what that means for how juveniles are treated in Wisconsin's justice system. First, superheroes and comic books are a big part of pop culture, and they seem to just get bigger and bigger. One Wisconsin author took his ideas for a new hero and turned it into a brand new comic book called The Hawk. It's getting a lot of attention and landed him on a panel at this year's Wizard World Convention in Madison, and he's 17 years old. William Miles is originally from Dodgeville and lives in Fenimore, Wisconsin. A senior at Fenimore High School, he's the author of the self-published comic book, The Hawk. William, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Have you always been a fan of comic books?
Yes, I have. I've been a fan ever since I was probably in fourth or third grade.
What were some of the ones you remember looking at that early age?
Oh, it was on a little rack in Piggly Wiggly down in Dodgeville back when it was they still had comic book racks. Like, it was one small rack, and I used to get the Amazing Spider-Man. It was a comic that was going on at that time, and a couple other miscellaneous titles, but mostly it was Spider-Man. I grew up with Spider-Man. So,
when did you first start creating your own images and stories?
It was seventh grade. I mean, it was really nothing. You know, it was nothing really that big, but I was sitting in the middle of math class, as you do, and I was bored, and I wasn't paying attention to the teacher because I don't like math. And the idea came into my head that this is what I want to do. I don't know why I'm waiting. You know, I want to do this in life. So it came then, and then later in life, I decided to actually pursue it.
Yeah, so it's one thing to, you know, just draw during math class.
Yeah.
What led you to this project of creating a comic book, not a web only? I mean, I'm looking at a print version
two physical ones right here, yeah.
This is a big job. What led you to say, okay, I'm going to actually make a comic book?
Well, I was going through some pretty hard times back in, I moved from my old school, Dodgeville High, to Fenimore High. There was a lot going on there. And I decided, instead of being really angry about what was going on, I kept on saying, I really want to do this. So why not do it? You know what I mean? Why? And this will help, you know, deal with some inner demons that are going on at the time. And then after I was even over that, I decided to keep on going with it. And I was finally able to, produce a full 24-page comic.
Now let's meet the Hawk. Tell us about your superhero here.
So the Hawk, his name is Ryan Vlory, and he is from Madison, Wisconsin. The comic takes place in Madison, Wisconsin, so where we're at right now. And it is about a young boy who is raised by a mentally and physically abusive father named James Vlory, who runs all crime trade in Madison. You know, he's like the biggest boss of Madison. He deals with all crime whatsoever. So he decides that he wants his son to be like that too, but his son doesn't want to be like that. And so as he starts to grow up, he realizes that's not who I am. That's not who I want to be, you know, kind of starting things off. And then without kind of spoiling things from there, things get messy.
Right. So, I mean, this is a protagonist with some inner demons and definite father issues.
Exactly.
Here. Not to spoil anything too much.
Yeah. He's got a lot of like family issues, altogether it pushes the story. You know what I mean? That is his family is the inciting incident,
right? You know, and narrative wise, this is fairly complicated because you're in the present, but a lot of that backstory you just shared is in flashback.
Yeah, this very first issue starts in the very beginning. Did you end up reading the comic or no?
I read a good chunk of it, and at the beginning, he's like beating up bad guys and trying to get to the main bad guy. But then we see some of those inciting incidents back at age 6.
Yes. So we start out from the very in the very beginning. We start out with him trying to find his father, and you don't know why. You know what I mean? I'm trying to leave a little bit of, you know, mystery. What's going on? You know what I mean? What's happening? From there, we get to see him kind of go back and go over some of these events that happened that led him to where he is now.
Talking to William Miles, senior at Fenimore High School, about his new creation, the self-published comic book, The Hawk. Okay, so that's our character and a taste of the story, again, without spoiling it too much. Now, for people who have never made their own comic book, can you talk about what the challenges are in actually bringing this from ideas in your head to something you can, you know, wrap up and hand to somebody?
Oh my gosh. You know, it was a process, because especially being 17, not knowing anything whatsoever, you know, just deciding to head dive right into this. I actually started this whole thing. We were on a family vacation all the way up in Branson, Missouri.
Okay.
And I was sitting there, and like I said, those events were still bothering me, and then I decided to start doing it there. I had no clue whatsoever what I was going to do. I just went, okay, I can do this, and started plowing through, and all of a sudden I was like, oh, you need to do this, and you need to do that, and you need to do this. And before I knew it, I was probably $500 extra that I did not need to spend. You know what I mean? So mm-hmm. if I had to give a tip, there's a couple things. The first thing is make sure to research what you're doing. I mean, there's plenty of forums online that explain, don't do this. Because I did that.
You'd already
and
done
now
that.
And I regret it now. Like spending too much money or making sure that the artist knows what, you know, what is the final script. Because that was an issue. I had sent off the script and I was like, oh, no, I don't want that in there. You know what I mean? But so make sure you know what you're doing. And the other thing I would say is a lot of people in life, and I'm not trying to be rude by saying this at all, but a lot of people in life, you know, they try to say, well, I can't do it. I got this going on, this going on, this going on. Don't let any of that get in the way. Keep on pushing and pursue what you want to do. If I would have let that happen, I would have given up right in the very beginning. But you got to push.
What was it like the first time you held the completed copy in your hand and, like, you knew? I love the, you know, at the end of Lost, there's a little tag like, I made this. Like, yeah. Is that how you felt then?
I finished it a year later, and just this last summer, we went to Michigan for a family trip, and it came in before I could see it. Like, it came in that week I had ordered it, and I got home, and I want to see it, and I got home, and it's like I gave birth. Like, it was amazing. I couldn't believe that I actually was able to do something like this.
So. And now you were at the Wizard World event. This is a thing, mm-hmm. a lot of comic books, TV show people get together. And you actually have already done a panel on, I love this, super villain psychology, along with a comic book artist, I think a couple psychology PhD people. What was it like being up in that forum?
Well, when I got there, I was like, why did they put me up here with two psychologists? This doesn't make sense. Like, I was surprised that they put me up with two psychologists that know probably way more than a 17-year-old broke kid from Wisconsin. But I got up there. It was a lot of fun. And it was really good, you know, well done with having two psychologists be up there and two writers and art, like a, I think an artist and then me, who is a writer, be up there, because it kind of gives both views of how we, you know, create and write and how we perceive these villains. So, yeah, that was a lot of fun.
Now, this was number one of the series,
yes.
The Hawk.
Yep.
Having been through what you went through, is there going to be a 2, 3, and so on?
Now that I know what I'm doing, absolutely. And we have this whole thing together now. But at first, I was like, oh, I don't know if I can do this again. It took a whole year to jump through all these different obstacles and hoops. And finally, I was able to, get this out, this very first issue out. And now it's a lot easier. I know what I'm doing. I know where to go. I know how to print. I know how to upload. I know how to get everything out there. So, yeah.
And you said you started this in part because you're going through some stuff.
Yes.
We don't need to break down the details of that. But I hear from people a lot who are dealing with different kinds of things that embracing creativity, doing something artistic, can really help a lot. Did you find that along the way?
Absolutely. Because you can either sit and fret about it and do nothing and, like, waste a lot of time doing, you know, being upset with yourself and sitting in a corner and you know, being angry and not getting anything done. Or you can take all of that and turn it into a passion that you've wanted to do. Too many people let that go and go, well, I can't do it because I don't have enough time or this or that or any excuse. But really, you should just do it. You know what I mean? Especially with, like, anger and being upset and dealing with past trauma or anything of that sort. You should just continue to push. You know what I mean? And use that to keep on showing, like, hey, I can do this. So.
I don't want to put any pressure on you.
You did
the Hawk. You got more Hawk coming.
Yep.
But I imagine somebody like you has other ideas for other heroes in their head. Do you have ideas for, okay, once I get into this little bit, I have another story I want to pursue?
Yeah, so what's going on right now is this is a part one of part two. To kind of just introduce the character, mm-hmm. to get it out there. And people, I'm getting pretty positive reviews so far. But I would say that, or what I am going to say, is we have this little secret project that's going on behind the scenes with a completely different artist who actually is top of the notch. You know what I mean? He's really, really good. And he's going to be doing Volume 2, which is going to be with a bunch of brand new villains, a couple new heroes, new supporting characters, villains, yeah.
Kind of expanding the universe.
Yes, exactly. That's the plan for the second volume, is to get all these characters out there so you can see truly what his world is like in Madison, Wisconsin, in this different, very, very different Madison, Wisconsin.
And for people who want to visit the mean streets of Madison and check out the Hawk, where can they find your work?
They can find it on, I have bigcartel.com/thehawk. You can buy the comic book on there. And if you go on The Hawk Comics on Instagram, that's where I do a lot of, a lot of fan art's posted. We've had a lot of fan art and, stuff like that, like promoting and advertising's on there.
People are already doing fan art.
Yeah, I have a lot of fan art. That was coming before the book was coming. I think people like the way the character looks. I mean, I think he looks pretty awesome. So, yeah.
Cool, William. Thanks a lot for sharing this with us.
Yeah, thank you.
William Miles is a senior at Fenimore High School. He's the creator of the self-published comic book, The Hawk. Coming up next, we'll talk to a criminal law expert about the impact of a new state Supreme Court ruling that says once a juvenile is tried as an adult in one part of the state, they're considered an adult for all other criminal charges in other parts of the state. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the U.S. ambassador to the European Union is the latest to testify in the ongoing impeachment inquiry. A political reporter will get us up to speed. First, the Wisconsin Supreme Court released a decision last week looking at how juveniles are treated in the state's criminal justice system. The court affirmed what's known as the once-an-adult, always-an-adult rule. That means that if a juvenile is tried in adult court in one case, they'll be tried as adult in future cases. In this new case, a 4-2 decision clarifies that if a juvenile is tried as an adult in one part of the state, all other courts treat them like an adult for current and future criminal offenses. Michael O'Hare is a professor of law at Marquette University. He specializes in criminal law and punishment. Michael, thanks for joining us.
Sure. Very happy to be with you.
Well, walk us through what this rule known as once an adult, always an adult means in our courts.
Well, sure. Normally, when a person who is a juvenile, that is to say somebody who is below the age of 17, commits a crime, that person will be prosecuted in a special juvenile court. But the state can request that a juvenile case be transferred to adult court where the case would be handled and sentenced in the same way as a regular adult criminal case. The Wisconsin statutes lay out various factors that need to be considered for this kind of a waiver. And this concept of once an adult, always an adult, or once waived, always waived, is that if a juvenile has once in one case been moved into adult court, then in any future case involving that same juvenile, the juvenile will be prosecuted right from the start in adult court without having to go through the regular waiver process in juvenile court.
Is that the standard now in Wisconsin before this Supreme Court case?
Yes. This approach has been well established in Wisconsin. When it comes to multiple cases prosecuted against a single juvenile in a single county, now this new case, the Hinkle case, presents a fairly unusual scenario where you have a juvenile who is waived into adult court in one county and then prosecuted for another serious crime in a different county. So the Wisconsin Supreme Court was really trying to address for the first time the question of whether this rule, once an adult, always an adult, whether that rule applies across the state or whether it's just county by county.
What was the majority's reasoning for ruling that, in fact, yes, this rule did apply here?
Well, the majority's reasoning was based pretty much entirely on a linguistic analysis of the statutory language. The majority didn't really engage at all with the question of what the best policy approach would be. So carefully parsing the language, the majority decided that there was a clear legislative intent to have this once-waived, always-waived rule applied uniformly across all 72 counties in Wisconsin.
Did the two dissenting justices argue fundamentally against the once-an-adult, always-an-adult rule?
No, they were addressing just this question of what do you do if you have somebody who is drawing multiple cases in multiple different counties. And the two dissenters, in part, did their own linguistic analysis and felt that the legislative intent was different than what the majority had decided. But the dissenters also took a look at the overarching purpose of the juvenile justice system, which is to provide rehabilitation for juvenile offenders. And the dissenters thought that it would be best, with that idea in mind, to have each county make its own separate decision about the rehabilitative needs of the offender. And that in fact, ties into one of the arguments that the defendant in this case, Hinkle, was making. He said, all right, well, I got waived into adult court in Milwaukee County. Now I'm facing prosecution in Fond du Lac County. And he thought that maybe the rehabilitative services in Fond du Lac County would be better than the rehabilitative services in Milwaukee County. So just because Milwaukee County decided that that it couldn't do anything very productive with Mr. Hinkle through the juvenile court system doesn't necessarily mean that Fond du Lac County would be similarly poorly positioned to provide rehabilitative services.
Talking to Michael O'Hare, professor of law at Marquette University, looking at the idea of trying juveniles as adults in court cases and whether they're once tried as an adult, they have to be tried again as adults in the future. Stepping away from the details of this particular state Supreme Court case, Michael, what have been the trends when it comes to treating juveniles as adults? Have we been changing on balance what we do over time?
Well, there has definitely been a big nationwide trend over the past 20 years or so to try to reinvigorate juvenile justice systems and to reinvigorate that traditional ideal that juvenile justice is about rehabilitation. We did, as a nation, and in Wisconsin in the 1990s, we did go through this period of getting very, very tough on juvenile crime. I don't know if you remember from that era the super predator buzzword that was frequently bandied about. People had the feeling that that there were quite a few violent juvenile offenders who were so-called super predators who could not possibly be rehabilitated. And so the law got a lot tougher in the 90s, and there was a lot more of an effort to shift juvenile offenders into adult courts. And that happened in Wisconsin, too, and the current laws that we have for that process in Wisconsin, in fact, were adopted in the mid-90s. But the research has really shown that approach was not an effective one, and that the whole idea of the super predator was misguided. And so there has been this national trend since 2000 toward reducing the use of adult facilities to deal with juveniles and getting back to rehabilitative ideas. And in fact, in a number of states, the age of jurisdiction of the juvenile courts has been raised. In many states, including Wisconsin, the juvenile court age was reduced in the 90s, and now the national trend is going the other direction. There have been efforts in Wisconsin in recent years to get the legislature to bump our age up as well, but those efforts have not been successful yet. So we still have that cutoff at the 17th birthday. But in many other states, the 17-year-olds are still handled in the juvenile court system, not in the adult system.
You mentioned research on the impact of trying juveniles as adults. Do we have research out there on this narrower subset of people who might have fallen into that once an adult, always an adult category?
I'm not aware of any research specifically on that group of people, but I would just underscore, though, the general point that has been found by many researchers, which is that committing crimes, even committing serious crimes as a juvenile, does not necessarily predict that the person will be a highly dangerous individual as an adult. And I think we can all associate in our own lives, and you know, maybe particularly if we're parents of teenagers, as I am, that those teen years are a highly turbulent period of life, and that there's a tremendous amount of change that happens across the teenage years. So while an adult's serious criminal history may be a pretty good indicator that that adult is dangerous and is likely to commit additional serious crimes in the future, the juvenile's criminal history is just simply not nearly as good an indicator of what the future of that juvenile will be like.
Michael, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Sure, very happy to.
That was Michael O'Hare, a criminal law expert with Marquette University. He was with us to talk about a recent Wisconsin State Supreme Court ruling. It says once a juvenile is tried as an adult in one court in Wisconsin, they're considered an adult for all future and current criminal offenses in the state. Coming up after the news, we'll talk with a Washington reporter about the latest in the impeachment inquiry hearings and look ahead to tonight's Democratic presidential debate. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, three candidates running in April's state Supreme Court race met yesterday for their first debate. WPR's state capitol reporter will recap what they had to say and where the race goes from here. First, we take a look at the week in Washington. The U.S. House has passed a government spending bill. Democrats are facing off in another debate tonight. And the big news is a full week of public hearings in the impeachment inquiry into President Trump. The U.S. ambassador to the European Union, a member of the National Security Council, an aide to the vice president, and others have all testified in front of the House Intelligence Committee. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you've been listening or watching the hearings this week, what sticks out to you? Do the witnesses strike you as credible? Do you have questions about the details of what's happening in this ongoing inquiry? What do you want to see or hear next? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Reed Wilson is a national correspondent for The Hill. Reed, good to have you back on the show.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
Well, Gordon Sondland, U.S. Ambassador to the European Union, someone heavily involved in working with Ukraine, though that's not part of the European Union, testified today. Here's a bit of his opening statement.
I know that members of this committee frequently frame these complicated issues in the form of a simple question. Was there a quid pro quo? As I testified previously, with regard to the requested White House call and the White House meeting, the answer is yes.
Reed, this is 7 hours of testimony. A lot happened today. What were your main takeaways from Gordon Sondland's testimony?
Well, I don't think it's too much of a stretch to equate part of what Gordon Sondland said, especially that little clip you just played, with John Dean's testimony before the House during the Nixon impeachment trial. That Dean's testimony back then, oh so long ago, was the moment when the nation really began to believe that the President Nixon was going to be removed from office. And while I don't think that Sondland's testimony has changed that much, some of the reactions from Republican senators indicate that it has not changed that much. But this is clearly the moment, I think, when we can say that the president is going to be impeached, if not removed, by the Senate. He'll be impeached by the House. This was some pretty dramatic testimony, and we saw just a revelation after revelation, it seemed like, that tied everybody, every senior official in the administration, from Secretary of State Mike Pompeo to Vice President Mike Pence to the president himself. And he kept, Sondland kept saying again and again, everyone was in the loop. And that struck me as something that's going to be replayed over and over. I mean, this is a historical day here in Washington.
And let's talk about who Gordon Sondland is. A lot of the previous people giving testimony had worked in D.C. in one capacity or another for a long time. So Republicans said, hey, these are bureaucrats who didn't like President Trump, the swamp, the deep state, whatever. Gordon Sondland's another story. He has been a business person for most of his life. He really only entered diplomacy last year when he was appointed by the Trump administration as this ambassador to the European Union. Does that make it more difficult for Republicans, his background?
Yeah, and not only was he did he just enter diplomacy, I mean, he was handpicked by President Trump after donating $1 million to the Trump Inaugural Committee. Sondland is a wealthy hotelier whose hotels are based in Portland. He's actually from my hometown of Seattle, but he has started to play a bigger and bigger role in politics, in Republican politics out in the Pacific Northwest. Then he made this big giant donation of $1 million to the Inaugural Committee, and President Trump nominated him to the position of ambassador to the European Union, and apparently they were pretty close. Sondland said that the two of them had had multiple conversations by phone. He even intimated that their conversations got a little salty at times, and they could sort of joke back and forth using what he called four-letter words. So that tells you, I mean, this is President Trump later today tried to walk back his own relationship, said he didn't know Sondland very well. But Sondland painted a much different picture on Capitol Hill, and apparently he has the president's personal phone number.
Now, President Trump and some Republicans on the committee highlighted Sondland saying that in one of his phone calls with the president, he asked what Trump wanted from Ukraine. The reply was nothing, no quid pro quo. The president really highlighting that as a defense, saying he wasn't asking for anything. Others pointing to the timing of this. This is almost a month after the initial whistleblower complaint, news filtering out about its existence. What's the back and forth on that particular statement?
Well, look, the president has said all along that he didn't ask for a quid pro quo, and it may be true that he didn't say those exact words to Gordon Sondland. And as a matter of fact, the committee chairman, Adam Schiff, made the point that, you know, you don't have to say the actual words for a quid pro quo to exist. Gordon Sondland believed it existed. He said several others had been read into this, including Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and even Vice President Mike Pence. Now, Pence's officials have denied that in the last few hours, but he has implicated a lot of people today in what Sondland has described as a pretty obvious quid pro quo. The request for the Ukrainians to publicly say that there were going to be these investigations into the Bidens and their relationship with this Ukrainian business in exchange for a White House meeting and eventually for security funding.
And there's one statement about pressure on the Ukrainian president. Sondland said, I'm quoting here, he had to announce the investigations. He didn't have to actually do it, as I, Sondland, understand it. So making the point that the announcement of investigations was what they were searching for, at least, again, according to Sondland himself.
Which ties this back to the fact that the president was seeking a favor for political purposes rather than some kind of altruistic way of cutting down corruption with Ukraine. That was another pretty significant moment, I thought, when, you know, Sondland acknowledged that the investigation was not about rooting out corruption. It was about damaging a political opponent. And frankly, if an investigation is announced and it is conducted, or even if it's not conducted, it's just the fact that it's announced, that gets repeated on American television media. I was in Iowa a couple of weeks ago talking to voters, and I talked to a couple of Democrats who were saying, yeah, this Ukraine stuff sounds really sketchy about Vice President Joe Biden, even though the allegations of impropriety have been debunked again and again, and he's never been accused of any actual impropriety.
Talking to Reed Wilson from The Hill, looking at the top stories in national politics, including the ongoing impeachment inquiry. And join in with your thoughts on what you've seen and heard at 800-642-1234. We also had a full slate of testimony yesterday, including from Lieutenant Colonel Alex Vindman, member of the National or a staffer at the National Security Council, who was on that July 25th call between Presidents Trump and Zelensky of Ukraine. Here he is talking about his reaction to learning that investigations were being sought while military aid was being held up.
Frankly, I couldn't believe what I was hearing. It was probably an element of shock that maybe in certain regards, my worst fear of how our Ukraine policy could play out was playing out. and how this was likely to have significant implications for U.S. national security.
Reed, what stuck out to you from Vindman's testimony?
Vindman was, his very physical appearance is what stuck out to me. He showed up in full dress uniform, which is what a military officer is supposed to do when he or she testifies before Congress. He established himself as an incredibly credible witness right off the bat, and someone who has a deep faith in this country. I mean, he even went as far as to address his father, an immigrant from the Soviet Republic, or from the Soviet Union, and said, "Dad, you know, the reason I'm testifying here is because this is America where right wins out." I can't remember his exact phrasing, but that was powerful. I mean, here is an immigrant whose parents fled the Nazis and the Soviet Union to come to the United States, and has now served his country, including receiving a Purple Heart for his time in Iraq. And here he is testifying that the president of the United States asked for an investigation into a political opponent. He is a direct witness to the initial complaint that the whistleblower brought up, and verifies a number of the facts within that complaint. And I thought it was a remarkable moment, especially just the physical sight of him sitting there with a Purple Heart on his chest, testifying before Congress.
More testimony coming up still this week. A big part of the story is who's not testifying. Who are some of the key figures that Congress would be interested in talking to that haven't been made available by the White House?
Well, we haven't heard anything from Mick Mulvaney, the White House Chief of Staff, who seemed to indicate that he might be willing to testify. At some point, he joined a lawsuit that basically sought to figure out whether or not officials from the White House could be compelled to testify by Congress or could be blocked by President Trump. John Bolton is another party to that lawsuit. Mulvaney, I should say, eventually withdrew from that suit. But John Bolton, the former National Security Advisor, is still a part of that suit and is supposedly willing to testify if a court will allow him to. Now, Bolton seems to have the timeline is a little hazy here, but Bolton's departure from his White House position earlier this year came right around the time when some of the security assistance may have been held up. Bolton's attorney has hinted that he knows of substantial events in this calendar that would add to Congress's understanding of just what happened. So if he testifies, he is likely to shed some light on this. And by the way, I should say there's an irony here, too. The Democrats have loathed John Bolton and his foreign policy influence over the Republican Party for decades now. And if he ends up becoming another bombshell in favor of the Democratic impeachment of a Republican president, that there's going to be a substantial sort of irony in the universe there.
We're talking to Reed Wilson, national correspondent at The Hill, about this week's round of public hearings in the impeachment inquiry. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been watching? Have you been listening? What struck you most about the hearings in the impeachment inquiry so far? Do the witnesses seem credible to you? What do you make the president's response to all of this? Do you have questions about what comes next? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Reed Wilson, national correspondent at The Hill, looking at some of the big stories in national politics. Coming up tonight, Reed, a Democratic presidential debate. Still plenty of candidates in this race. What are you watching for in the news lately that might change what happens tonight on stage?
Well, I'm really watching what is happening in Iowa and New Hampshire in terms of who's got the momentum. I mean, here we are. We're only about 2 months away from the Iowa caucuses, about 2.5 months away from the Iowa caucuses, which kick off the first round of voting. And in polls this week, we've seen a new front runner in both Iowa and New Hampshire, and that's South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg. He has leapt to the lead in polls in both places, and he has become sort of the alternative to former Vice President Joe Biden in that sort of moderate establishment lane, if you will. I'm going to watch how he handles the front-runner mantle. Is he going to he's going to face the slings and arrows from his fellow Democrats. How does he weather that? This is somebody who has been on a national debate stage only four times before in the four previous debates that Democrats have held. It feels like a lot more than five debates, doesn't it? Is he going to sort of collapse under the pressure of the national spotlight, or can he hold his own? The other thing I'm watching for is who emerges from the progressive lane as the real front runner, if you will. Elizabeth Warren has been the leader of that within that sort of segment of the party for most of the year now. What's Bernie Sanders going to do? Bernie Sanders has among the most committed fans of any candidate in the Democratic Party, but there aren't that many of them. Everybody I've talked to in Iowa and New Hampshire who says that they are a Sanders supporter now says that they were a Sanders supporter 4 years ago, too. That tells me he's not really grown his base much beyond the sort of solid core of fandom. Where does he grow? Will he go after Elizabeth Warren, who is in fact a good friend of his, or will Warren come after him and try to take some of his base too? So I'm watching sort of those two lanes here, those two matchups, if you will: Biden versus Buttigieg, Harris versus Sanders versus Warren, and we'll see who emerges as sort of the top of the heap at the moment. So far this year, Warren and Buttigieg have been the two best debaters on stage, I think, by a country mile.
And polls at this point have misled us before. We've seen people in crowded fields kind of rise and fall before any single votes are cast. Do you see a lot of room for movement up and down before the Iowa caucuses?
Oh, certainly. You talk to any Iowa voter, and they don't tell you who they're backing. They give you the list of the three or four candidates that they're actively considering, and to the point at which the best-known pollster in Iowa, a woman named Ann Selzer, actually asked people, who's your first choice, who's your second choice, and who are you actively considering? She comes up with an index that shows people's sort of growth potential. And the thing that has leapt out at me is that the two people who have the best growth potential and have for a very long time now are Warren and Buttigieg. Even when they didn't lead the pack, they were on the most people's list. And there's a bizarre anecdote. There's a little coffee shop in Des Moines where the entire political class gets their coffee in the morning before they head out doorbelling. And that the house next door, the house of the owners, the car out front has a Buttigieg sticker and a Warren sticker. So presumably you got one fan of one and one of the other in that household. But that tells you a little bit about just how broad Iowans' perspective is. And yeah, I remember back in 2003 at this point, this was Howard Dean's race to lose, and he was running tough against Dick Gephardt. Well, those two spent the last 2 months of the campaign going after each other, and John Kerry and John Edwards finished first and second. So yeah, you're right. A lot can change.
Well, a couple candidates with nothing but growth potential because they're just getting into the race. Former Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick is in. Former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg is in, I think-ish. What do you make of them getting into the race?
Well, I think it's a reflection of a worries that former Vice President Joe Biden is not the candidate that people thought he was. Both Patrick and Bloomberg come in from the sort of moderate wing of the Democratic Party. Patrick complicates things for Elizabeth Warren a little bit because they may share a voter base. I mean, there are a lot of people from Massachusetts who voted for the same people or the same, both of them. And then, of course, they are both very well known in neighboring New Hampshire. Michael Bloomberg is an interesting case because he has spent more money on American politics than I think anybody else in the last 2-3 years. He spent more than $100 million on the Democrats' chances, Democratic candidates and political action committees in the 2018 midterm elections. If he's in the race, spending a lot of money on himself, that's a big hole that Democrats need to fill funding-wise. Now, in the meantime, Bloomberg has said he'll spend something like $100 million on digital advertisements against President Trump. And now just today, he announced he'd spend a lot more on voter registration drives as well. So he's signaling that this is about more than just himself. But this is clearly the sort of business moderate wing of the Democratic Party that is having a bit of a freak out that Joe Biden is not the candidate that he was, or the candidate that they thought he was, and that they need somebody who can pull the debate to the right, away from sort of the Warren Harris wing or the Warren Sanders wing of the party that is much more concerned with you know, taxing the wealthy.
Talking to Reed Wilson, national correspondent at The Hill, looking at some of the top stories in national politics. Heading back over to Congress, yesterday the U.S. House passed a spending bill to keep the government running for a whole 4 more weeks. This goes to the Senate now. So what's up? Why are we again passing short-term spending bills?
Well, they can't agree on a few provisions, and those provisions sort of keep changing, which ones are the sticking points. But this has been a problem. You know, in the middle of an impeachment inquiry, President Trump has suggested a few times that he may just shut down government. Now, of course, Congress wouldn't shut down if the government does shut down. But this is not exactly what you want to be doing, a year before you're running for re-election. Congress has not been able to agree to a long-term funding bill. But then again, we've seen this movie a lot of times before. People threaten to cancel Christmas vacation and stuff like that. And then at the last minute, everybody comes together and passes a bill and basically punts the ball another 6-8 months down the road. So that's really what I expect to happen. But there are still sticking points.
That is what happens, except when it doesn't. We have gotten to that shutdown point, or, you know, the partial shutdown technically before, but you're not seeing that as likely this time around?
No, I don't think so. The issues on which they're disagree or have yet to come to an agreement are just not big enough for a massive shutdown. It is not in anybody's political interest to shut down the government right now, especially during the middle of a primary season, during the beginning of a presidential campaign. This is not in anybody's interest. They will come to a deal. That's my prediction. Although you're right, I mean, this has happened before, and we've gone into January, including this January. Well, no, wait, last January. This January, when we did have a couple of weeks of a shutdown. That's this year has been a hell of a decade, hasn't it?
Yeah, the time does fly. The border wall, that's been a sticking point in a lot of recent both immigration bill efforts and funding bill efforts. Is that one point of contention, funding for the border wall that President Trump has been talking about?
Yeah, that's always the case. President Trump wants to be able to talk about the length of border wall that has been built during his presidency. The actual length of new wall that's been built is close to zero feet. And most of the reconstruction that's taken place has been on old sections of the wall. The Democrats in the House are not going to budge on that. They do not want they have never been interested in building a wall or increasing the wall along the Mexican border. And they have not been they're not terribly interested in giving President Trump a political win to fire up his base right before an election. So, President Trump has been calling this Congress the do-nothing Congress, and, he's kind of got a point.
Reed, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You got it. Thanks for having me.
Been talking to Reed Wilson, national correspondent at The Hill. He joined us for our weekly look at the top stories in national politics. We'll talk more about the impeachment inquiry tomorrow at 4:30. A law professor and former U.S. attorney will talk with us about some of the legal aspects of all of this, how the evidence stacks up, if it constitutes an abuse of power, and where the process goes from here. That's tomorrow at 4:30, and you can let us know what questions you have ahead of time. You can email ideas@wpr.org. And meanwhile, the public hearings of the House impeachment inquiry into President Trump continue this week. You can hear live coverage on Wisconsin Public Radio's NPR News and Classical Music Network starting tomorrow morning at 8. On Thursday morning, former NSC official Fiona Hill is expected to testify. You can also follow along online at WPR.org. That's live coverage of public impeachment inquiry hearings tomorrow morning at 8 on the NPR News and Classical Music Network and online at WPR.org. And tune in to Central Time again. That's tomorrow at 4:30 for more conversation and your chance to weigh in on the latest in the impeachment effort. That's tomorrow here on Central Time. Thanksgiving Day is coming up, and we have a special edition of Food Friday this week that we need your help for over the next couple of days. Our producers were talking about generational changes in Thanksgiving, where people are picking up hosting duties from their parents or maybe grandparents, and there's where you can help out. We're looking for some food advice from you for people who are hosting their first ever Thanksgiving get-together. Do you have tips on how to cook the classics in a timely and delicious manner? Have you tried something new and different on your Thanksgiving table? Do you have a story of a Thanksgiving dish gone wrong? Share your stories and your advice. You can call in live during the show on Food Friday, or you can start us off right now. Post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. What's your advice for that first-time Thanksgiving host? How can they not bite off more than they can chew? And do you do something, do you counter-program and do something completely different from the standard turkey, potatoes, stuffing, cranberry sauce, you name it? Let us know. Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.